This week on the BOAG World Show, we're joined by Danny Hearn, who worked for the UK retailer John Lewis. He shows us how you can build a user experience culture from the bottom up. This week's show is sponsored by Full Story and Balsamic. Hello and welcome to the BOAG World Show, the podcast about all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name is Paul BOAG and joining me is Marcus Lillington.
Marcus Lilling.
I don't know. I couldn't make up my mind whether I'm just going to say Marcus or Marcus Lillington and I just ended up butchering your entire name.
Somebody mentioned that I had one of those quite hard to say names. I think it was on the BOAG World Slack channel, actually. I can't remember what the exact thing was, but it made me respond saying along the lines, it was great when we were naming our kids, because you could think of all the names you can't have, and my favourite was Emily Lillington.
Yeah, so you've got far too many L's. That's your trouble.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sweating in here. It's very hot today.
It is hot. It's actually lovely where I am, of course, because I have my bifold doors open and I have my Velux window open and it's all just beautiful and perfect.
I'll tell you what, world. Just so I don't die, I'm going to open the Winchester traffic window. So if we have sirens, it'll just be part of the vibe.
Be part,
don't you think?
Part of the show. It makes it real and authentic.
Yeah, so give because, me you know, one sec. Yeah.
Oh, great. So I am sitting here while you're opening bloody windows. Why couldn't you have done this before we started? Not that you can hear me. This is a perfect opportunity to say nasty things about Marcus.
Enjoying talking to yourself.
I was having a lovely time. Thank you very much for asking.
You hear the noisy cars now?
Yes, absolutely.
There you go.
Yeah, perfect. I think that's added something special to the podcast.
So is your house all ready now? We don't have to do this in the middle of the night anymore.
No, we're past that point. There is, you know, a little bit still going on. There's odds and sods, you know, things like skirting boards in one or two places and little bits and bobs. But my study, my office, whatever you want to call it, that is done and dusted, which is lovely.
That's
and
great.
And it is going to be featured in .net magazine, don't you know?
What, your office is?
Yes.
What, as a feature or just as some nice pictures?
No, as a feature. 320 whole words written about it as well. Yeah.
Okay.
That's the kind of rock and roll lifestyle I lead.
Was .net turned into hello or something?
It does feel a little bit like that. It was really weird writing it. It's just like, what was... And in fact, they're not called .net magazine anymore. They're called Net Magazine. I get in trouble every time I add the dot in.
Okay.
They dropped it years back.
Yes.
But we're so old and decrepit that we've not moved on. Yeah, so that really annoyed my wife because we had a bit of a competition going on. She was doing the kind of loungy area and I was doing this study officey area. And I win. Because mine's featured in a magazine, hers isn't. So no.
That's proper winning. Yeah, us calling it .net magazine is like old people saying the interwebs or something like that. Isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. The information superhighway. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. We should
and
bring it back.
Cyberspace.
We should bring the information superhighway back.
Because it just trips off the tongue, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it would turn into the ISH, the ish, very quickly.
The ish,
yes.
So there we go. That's my news. My house is nearly done. Do you have any news? Anything that people don't care about?
Yeah, of course. Oh, well, loads of things that people don't care about. My first grandchild is about to be three. That's a nice thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a nice age. Nice age. I like that.
They're fabulous when they're that age. Why? Everything is why.
And also you can really wind them up and then hand them back.
Oh, totally. Yes, totally. Mm. Give them sweets.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make out that it's so much more fun at grandma and granddad's house.
Yeah.
All of those king things. But anyway.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of the news at the moment.
Okay.
I've probably got something really important I've forgotten. I told you last week that I went to a conference. Well, I went to the conference and I did my talk and it went very well.
Oh, good.
But why is it when you're sort of in there, in air quotes, networking, talking to people, they say, so what are you working on at the moment? And I go,
I know, right?
Every time.
It's like you're not doing anything. It's really embarrassing, isn't it?
And this was
the only thing that can spring to mind is some really shitty little piece of work that you have to do.
Yeah, but yeah, this was higher ed as well, so it was specifically, what are you doing in higher ed?
You can have that again in a couple of weeks because we're off to IWMW, aren't we?
Yes, but I've practiced it now, so, well, not literally practiced it, but I've had practice at responding to that, so I can actually trip off the tongue two or three now.
Ah, there you go. Good man. Okay, so what's your thought for the day today?
Well, this comes, as you said, you thought because I was speaking on customer journey mapping last week that I would talk about it last week, thought of the day, and I didn't, but I am going to today.
Okay.
Because it's front of mind and all that stuff.
While you do that, I'm just going to eat an apple.
That's going to be really noisy. You completely thrown me off my train
of thought. I've got a mouthful of apple.
You would have done that even more so if you'd continued with the apple.
I'll just
swivel your chair around. Swivel your chair around away from... No. Swivel your chair around away from the mic. And then you can hear me and listen and still eat the apple.
Okay. All right, then. Carry on. Yeah, okay, go for it.
But you can't comment on what I'm going to say. I could ask you questions and then nothing will come back. We have to spin around really quickly. Anyway, so the talk on customer journey mapping was split between me and somebody called Jane from Birkbeck University, who we'd worked with doing research, but one of the main aspects of that research was doing some customer journey mapping. And I guess the main reason why the talk came about was because the journey mapping led to some quite significant changes within the organisation. So it's a bit of a success story. You're not going to be talking about something that didn't really work, something that got put in a drawer and forgotten about. But in this case, it wasn't, which was great. So my part of the talk was along the lines of kind of what customer journey mapping is, why it's worth doing if you do it right. So, and that kind of started off in this area of, certainly when we started looking at customer journey mapping, we kind of just saw it as another tool in the UX toolbox. And it's quite a lot more than that. It's something that's just as we've experienced from doing it, the kind of results that you get are much more strategic rather than the kind of results that you'd get from doing a card sorting exercise, for example. So I started, that was kind of the first thing I started talking about. Then I started looking into how you need to look at the different user journeys. You need to note that there are many, many different journeys. There certainly are within higher ed. There's probably 50 different types of prospective student. oh no, Paul's dying.
I've just choked on my apple. Go on, carry on. It's fine.
Are you sure?
Yeah.
I don't need to do the Heimlich manoeuvre from afar.
No, it's okay. It's fine. Sorry about that.
was that comedy choking?
Maybe.
I think it was.
You were boring me.
Yes, I figured that.
Well, I've had to put up with however many seasons of you interrupting me in the middle of me making some profound comment.
Usually because I'm bored. Like, you're right.
It
fair enough.
Just felt like time.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. So,
Isn't it? It's difficult to recover, isn't it? Isn't it really annoying, Marcus?
It is quite tricky, but no, that's fine. You carry on, Paul. Do what you feel you need to do. Have you finished yet?
Yeah, I've finished.
Are you sure?
Well, I haven't finished the apple, but I'm going to stop eating it.
Okay. You need to note that there are many, many different journeys and that they're all different. So therefore, you need to focus on the most important journeys rather than kind of thinking, well, I need to cover everything, or I need to do the user journey from point A to point Z, when maybe if you concentrated on point D to G or whatever, you'd do a much better job of it. And also you might not go mad in the process of trying to do too much. Okay. And the next point was Talking about touch points, so within these many customer journeys, there are also many touch points, and that touch points aren't certainly not just websites. They could be anything. Somebody picking up the phone, they could be somebody making a recommendation on social media, etc. The whole point here is it's complex. Don't think this is something that you can just do for 10 minutes. You need to think about it, you need to plan it, and you need to have research that feeds into it. Most important point, though, I think, and this is key, is that you need to ensure that you have as broad a representation of your organisation within the room as possible. Most people don't like that because it's hard. They don't want to have people from finance or whatever in their room. They just want their nice UX buddies in the room. But if you do that, you're only going to get kind of very narrow responses or results. So the broader you make it, the more likely that mapping is going to make cause strategic change within your organisation, which is what happened at Birkbeck. I'm nearly there, Paul. Are you awake? Yeah, I thought so. Okay. So you need to note how people are feeling. That's one of the quite important aspects, which at the time I was like, really? You need to care about sort of what people are thinking, you know, how they feel at a particular point, but it is actually relevant because one of the weaknesses of the Birkbeck journey was post-application. So people were kind of... They didn't need to be encouraged to interact because they wanted to apply. So it was like kind of pre- and post-application, actually. But they were quite anxious, and if they needed help, they needed it really quickly. And they picked up the phone, and one of the problems with the system there was that and under kind of times of duress like that, their phone system couldn't cope with it. So that was a strategic change. That was changed. So a strategic change that happened because of the journey mapping recognizing it.
Cool.
And that's pretty much it. I mean, you can do cool maps that people can put on walls to remind them of the journeys so that they don't get put in drawers and forgotten about. But yeah, it's really that kind of high-level stuff. It's complicated. Make sure you've got as wider or as broad a representation as possible in the room.
I have actually written a very detailed guide to customer journey mapping on Boag World, so I'll put a link in the show notes if you want to check that out. But thank you very much, Mark. Actually interesting.
Quite interesting. I've actually read your post, Paul. It's a good one.
Oh, there you go. All right. Well, let's talk quickly about our first sponsor for the day, which is Balsamic. Are back again, and I have finally this never-ending video training course I'm doing. I've finally finished writing the script for it now, which is like, yes, thank goodness
I'm not doing this deliberately because you did it to me, but I'm not. I thought I must mention this on the podcast this afternoon. Lee, Ed, and myself were using Balsamic this morning to develop wireframes between the three of us in different locations.
Yay! How did that work? Did it work all right?
Yeah, fine.
It would have been terrible if you said it was awful.
The one thing we weren't sure whether we could do versioning. I was just saving and it changed everything. But doesn't matter. It's all sort
I
of
don't
early
know
days.
The answer to that. And that's interesting.
But yeah, this is just we're just doing some new stuff on the Headscape site. So it's like, that's a good idea. Let's use Balsamic. So
absolutely, yes. If you're working remotely, Balsamic is a really great way of all working together. There is a there is a desktop app as well for if you're working by yourself, but there's also this cloud-based service which is great for that kind of collaborative stuff. So it's definitely worth giving a go. I was going to give an example myself of how I used it when I was working with University of Lincoln, but you know, you've used it this morning, so yours is more recent, so you win, I guess.
Save that one for next week, Paul.
Oh, I will do. All right. So Balsamic, as you can see, is a great tool for doing wireframing, for collaborating together. Go and check it out. Really, I don't think there's anything else to say. If you haven't checked it out by this point in the season, I really despair.
That's a noisy car, motorbike.
What the
vehicle.
Hell was that?
I think it was a motorbike, an old motorbike. There you go. It's gone now, sort of.
Just so unprofessional, says the man eating an apple.
At least I'm still alive. I was thinking I'm going to die if I don't open the window.
Yeah, no, that's a fair comment. So to give Balsamic a go, you could get a 30-day free trial by going to balsamic.cloud. And you can get, actually, after that 30 days, if you go to sign up and you enter all your billing information, etc., if you put in the code BOAG World alongside that information, you'll get an additional 3 months for free, which means that you'll get 4 months of usage in total without paying a penny, which I think is pretty damn good. And I pretty much guarantee you'll keep using it. It's a really great tool. And they're obviously confident that you'll keep using it. Otherwise, they wouldn't give you 3 months for free, would they? Anyway, so that is Balsamic. Right, we come on to our interview for this week. And we're talking to Danny Hearn from the UK retailer John Lewis. Or he isn't there anymore, actually. He's moved on and become a freelance consultant and UX-y person. But he spent a long time working in John Lewis, which is a big retailer here in the UK, if you don't know. And it is a really, really fascinating interview, and slightly unusual, as you probably gathered by the title of this podcast episode, if you've seen it, which was How John Lewis's UX Revolution Began in the Canteen. It's a very interesting story, and a really encouraging one as well. So here's the interview with Danny. So, Danny, thank you so much for joining us today. Just to kind of kick things off, could you maybe tell people a little bit about what you're doing now, and then also what you were doing previously at John Lewis?
Yeah, okay, yeah, thanks, Paul, and yeah, thanks for having me on the infamous Spoke World. It's very, very exciting to finally have arrived.
Oh, well, the pinnacle of your career, no doubt.
Exactly, it's all downhill from here. So.
Exactly.
well, I've just moved out. So I was in London. I was doing the kind of contracting scene. And I've kind of moved into like consulting, and I've tried to position myself so that I'm sort of going a bit beyond your average UXer, and I'm actually moving into kind of helping organizations solve big customer problems. And sometimes that's through standard UX techniques, and sometimes that means, you know, really coaching founders and coaching development teams and really trying to help organizations resolve whatever they need to resolve in order to even have a UX practice in some cases. And I've recently, having done that for about a couple of years now, I've just moved out to Somerset.
Yeah, so, welcome to the West Country.
Yes, yeah, it's a familiar place for me because I did grow up in Totnes, so there's a familiarity to it. But it's just a question. We were talking about this the other day of me kind of getting out of that London bubble and really trying to, you know, diversify and also, you know, look at how I can add value in a different way that might have worked in London. And to add another bow to that, I'm actually also kind of examining how I can bring everything I've learned from sort of 15 years of digital and, you know, the last 7 odd years in retail, and really looking at how I can bring that into the charity and not-for-profit sector. So that's going to be my next kind of big challenge that I'm looking at, in how to, yeah, move everything over to that world.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So tell us a little bit about your experience before the contracting, because you were at John Lewis, that's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I was at John Lewis for 5 years. And prior to that, I'd had a few full-time jobs and I'd done a bit of contracting and stuff. But John Lewis was, about 5 years.
So for those people that don't know, those people that maybe aren't from the UK, who is John Lewis, and what kind of work were you doing for them?
Sure, yeah. Well, John Lewis is, I mean, they certainly like to say they're sort of Britain's favourite retailer. It's actually not a standard business. It's partnership, which is one of the really big features of the way that the business runs and the culture works. So basically everybody has a stake in the business. Everyone has a sort of share of the bonus and they can vote on things. There's a council. It's very democratic. So it has a real sense of value running through it, and its ethos when it started was to sort of provide a better lifestyle to the working class, which is over 150 years ago. So it's got that kind of history and gravitas to it, and they have, you know, lots of big department stores selling, you know, everything you can imagine for a household, and it's, you know, it's a pretty big business, really.
So what about your role when you were there? What kind of work were you doing?
Yeah, so initially I went in as a UX lead. I joined the user experience team sort of, you know, on the seventh floor in Victoria, you know, so it's quite, you are kind of initially a very small cog in a very big machine. And initially I came in, the team was pretty brand new. I think that, you know, someone had been away on maternity cover and there were a lot of new hires. So everybody was a little bit wide-eyed. It was kind of like a new world. And just as I was starting to begin the job, it transpired that we needed to do a replatforming, which for any retailer, you know, is pretty much the biggest thing that a website can do. And it can have quite profound impacts on the culture, on the team, on the company, and in the end, the experience. And that was really like the first kind of big project that I worked on. But then following that, I transitioned into UX manager, and I really had this journey, which was quite, you know, quite profound for me, and had quite an impact on the business. And it was really something I didn't expect. I kind of thought that initially it would just be a standard sort of full-time job, and I was in the UX team, and, you know, I would just kind of make good experiences, and that would kind of be the end of it. But what actually happened during those 5 years was I kind of went on this really long ride of starting to chip away at the culture and chip away at the way of working. And that started with a small cookie crumb at the beginning of small changes. And it culminated in the end of sort of being able to run full departmental workshops, hackathons, introducing, you know, massive value proposition style methodology to different parts of the business, which was kind of way outside of the original remit of what my role was. And so that took 5 years to get there, you know, to that final point. And yeah, perhaps we can kind of go through some of that and I can see how it all happened.
Well, let's go back then to the very beginning when you first joined John Lewis. You know, because of the ethos behind John Lewis, you kind of in your head picture quite a user-centric culture already, that, you know, that they're very, you know, they're not a hard nose, we're going to screw loads of money out of you retailer. They feel something different. Was there a well-established user-centric culture, or, you know, was that something you were expected to introduce? What was the scenario in those early days?
That's a really good question. That's a really good point. I think John Lewis, when I started, you know, they had really, you know, for a long time had been nailing the customer experience in store. So, you know, that's where the reputation came from, where never knowingly undersold, and you could go in and you could, you know, exchange an item, no questions asked. And there was this real kind of ethos that you felt from the partnership, and customers really engaged with that. And I think when I started, the brand, it did have a lot of a halo effect, was what we'd often talk about, you know, where people would instantly go, oh, I love John Lewis. But I don't think we'd really managed at that point to translate that in-store customer experience onto the online experience. It hadn't happened yet. And I think that there was definitely that at a high level, the talk was really positive, you know, like we want to be the best customer experience and, you know, this kind of thing. But when you kind of went through the echelons of management and into IT projects, IT driven projects, and, you know, governance and funding, and then when it came down to the sort of, you know, oh, we need another week in order to deliver this, or we need a bit more time to understand this problem better. When it came down to those points there, I think that original intention of wanting a really good experience kind of got lost in the wash a little bit. This is right at the very start. And this is because, you know, digital, this is going back to 2011, it's a really different landscape to how it looks now. You know, this is, you know, I think digital teams were just suddenly being having had their own playground and they were just the website and, you know, people didn't take them too seriously, suddenly the websites were making more money than the rest of the shops.
Yeah.
And suddenly becoming a bit more of a serious business. So when I started, the website team had just been pulled away from startup culture and into a more of a kind of corporate and governance culture, which I don't think, you know, necessarily helped us kind of initially find our feet to create a good customer experience.
So, I mean, that's interesting then. So when you originally came on board, what were the expectations of your role? Were people seeing you as an implementer, or as a, did they expect you to provide leadership? Did they expect you to shake up things? What were the expectations?
I think you said it quite well in the first part. The role, as I felt that it was, rather than what was explained or whatever, like what I think was actually there, I was there to get projects delivered.
Yeah.
That was, you know, I was the, maybe the whip cracker, or, you know, I had to make sure that my UX team, you know, understood what they needed to do, the project was going on time, and that they wouldn't kind of delay the project. I think that was the biggest anxiety. It was all kind of about making sure things got delivered.
So, I mean, from the conversation you and I had a few days ago when we met up, you didn't stay at that, you know, you didn't allow yourself to be constrained by that expectation, as will become clear in a minute. I mean, what made you think you should or even could challenge that kind of existing culture? You know, didn't you feel that it was above your pay grade, for want of a better word?
It's a really good point. I think it is quite overwhelming if you haven't worked at enterprise level before. And I mentioned earlier, you know, on the seventh floor in Victoria, and you're in this huge building and there's thousands of employees, and the sense that you can make any change or any difference, like, I think at the time when I started, it felt very much like, you know, you're just sort of in this huge sea, and like no change was possible, and everything had been quite rigid for a while. And I can share a very small anecdotal story. I know that some people listening will roll their eyes because it's the one that I always tell, but I'm a bit of a health nut, and they have a canteen in Victoria, and I went down to the canteen, and every lunchtime, you know, I'd want to get my wanted baguette, and they'd always have these sort of quite stodgy white bread rolls. And I really wanted, you know, sort of healthy wholemeal rolls. And I, you know, I was kind of curious, but the culture was really like, that's what they serve, that's what they do, this is John Lewis, this is, you can't change those things, you know. It was really sort of like, nobody had ever done that, no one. And I was like, well, who orders the food here? Like, how does that work? And then it was like, where's the chef, you know? And they were like, well, I suppose we can tell you, you know, he's in that room there. And so I sort of went in and had a chat with him. I was like, I'd really like to get some healthier food in, you know, some wholemeal rolls, you know. And I had a conversation with him for about half an hour, and eventually he agreed to trial it. And it might sound like a really innocuous detail, but for me, that initially they started trialing it, and then from that point forward they always had wholemeal bread in the canteen. It felt like I'd managed to kind of move the needle in a very small way, and it wasn't even related to user experience, but I was like, it's possible to kind of find these departments that are buried in, you know, back offices and stuff, have a chat with someone and change something. And that was the first time that I felt, you know, everybody was kind of amused by it because it was kind of like a funny, ridiculous thing to spend your time doing and not really part of my job. But it happened, and I managed to do it, and I was like, now I can get, you know, wholemeal bread every day. And that was the first point where I thought, actually, I think that you can actually reach your hand out and sort of push back against this huge machine, and it does respond. So that, once I had that kind of impetus, I started to look for areas, you know, within UX that I wanted to change. And, you know, I'd been in agency land for quite a while, and we'd all use boards to, you know, like we had these big kind of thick art boards that we would do sort of sketches on and stuff. And sometimes we were told to put something on the board before the client comes around,
you know.
Yeah. It was what we were told. But there was a useful purpose to it, and it allowed us to think outside of our screens. And when I arrived at John Lewis, that a lot of the team was still kind of straight into Xera and straight, you know, designing straight off without really kind of going through a process. So I originally I wanted to get these boards, and that was a whole thing, because you could only get the stationery that was pre-agreed. Yeah. So I had to find out a little loophole with the stationery team to get my own stationery.
Yeah.
So it sounds like really small things, but actually for a team that was tired, and then some new people that had arrived that hadn't really seen anything change and were kind of a bit frustrated, to suddenly see that, they've got these moleskins and they've got these new markers and these boards. And so we're suddenly starting to sketch, and we're starting to put the boards of our design process next to our desks. And that was just the start. That was the cookie crumb where I started to see, you know, that those little things like that had actually started to change the way that we were designing.
So, I mean, that takes some tenacity, because it's so easy with things like that. You just go, oh, you know, okay.
100%.
We won't have whiteboards, you know, or we won't have moleskins or whatever else. What is, do you reckon that's just a character trait of yours, or was there, did you have a bigger agenda there, or you just kind of were determined to keep plugging away?
I'd actually, and I always feel a bit embarrassed, you know, to mention, but I read the Steve Jobs biography, the Walter Isaacson one. And I was really inspired by the way that Jobs had this, you know, obsession with perfection, and the way he made the inside of the machines absolutely, you know, perfect looking. And I kind of thought the small things matter was how it was, what I took from that. And that we shouldn't just do that because there was plenty of that. There was that kind of, we tried it before, it can't be done.
Yeah.
Stationery said no, you know. I mean, a really funny story with it was that when I got the boards, I wanted to mount them on the wall. And this was quite a kind of famous story. I wanted to mount them on the wall, which meant talking to facilities.
Yeah.
And facilities initially were like, you can't mount them on the wall, it's a fire hazard. Now, that's the point where you could hear that and just go, oh, well, we tried and they won't let us do it, it's a fire hazard.
Yeah.
I guess because I'm a bit antagonistic maybe, but I'm like, okay, what fire regulation specifically is it?
Yes, there you go.
Like, what's the actual rule? And they were going, well, it can't be, you know, if it's like 4 centimeters off the corridor. I said, well, these are like, you know, 5 mil. And it was just that kind of thing where I was like, I have to play the game here. Mm. I can't get rattled. I can't say, this is ridiculous, I'm stuck in a Kafka kind of nightmare. I can't say that. I just have to go, okay, what is the fire regulation? And when this is what I discovered, you know, in multiple examples where you get an initial resistance, that the initial, I used to call it like the antibodies of change. You suggested something that hasn't happened before, that they're not used to. They initially give you this kickback, and you just have to kind of stand your ground and just say, but in a really polite way, and be like, okay, so, you know, what fire regulation, that kind of thing. And when they kind of saw that I was just going to keep going, and I was going to keep looking for ways to kind of understand and unpick the resistance, there was this sort of, okay, and the magic word in a big organization is trial. That's the secret word, is that if you say we do it as a trial, then they don't have to commit to it, they don't get told off, and then you can do it, and then basically it just turns into the real thing.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really nice trick. So we said, well, let's do it as a trial. And so we got these magnetic rails in, and we, you know, I got them to drill it into the wall, and then we got magnets on the back of these boards and clipped them on the wall. Now, it might just sound like, you know, well, it's, you know, that just sounds like a kind of nice thing. You know, what's the big deal? It really made a difference, because suddenly the UX team have gone from this kind of department that you wouldn't even recognize sitting alongside accounts.
Yeah.
You know, to, they've got Sharpies. They're sketching things. Now that our designs are up on the wall, And then I can put a post-it note up on, like a big pad on the wall and say, like, let us know what you think, you know, and to get people to engage in our department with the designs that we were doing. Because sometimes they would just find out when it went live. It wasn't a fully developed practice at that point. So in pushing back on the fire regs, that meant we got the boards up on the wall. And then that meant that, you know, our work was exposed and it was creating conversation. And that was really like a big part of the change.
And also the principles that you've applied in those two stories that you've told, the boards and also the wholemeal bread, those scale up to anything, don't they, really? It doesn't matter, you know, it's the principle of don't accept that initial no. You know, question what the underlying problem is, talk about trialing it, and actually going and discussing face to face with the person that is the barrier. I mean, that applies whether you're talking about bread rolls or whether you're talking about, you know, compliance and governance issues or anything else, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, 100%. And I think, yeah, I very much avoided email as much as possible. You know, I was really on my feet. Face to face made a huge difference. Being persistent, politely persistent, and being curious, you know, and inquiring. I think those are really good principles. I think there is something about when you go into a big organization about thinking things are fixed, thinking things are set, you know, like, well, that's the way it was and that's been determined. And often a little bit of challenging, you'd be surprised at how many walls can actually be pushed over.
So, I mean, give us an example of a kind of the next level up from that. So, sure. You know, you've got a few basic things up and running, but you didn't stop there. You know, you kept pushing the boundary. So I'm interested in that.
Yeah. So I think where things started to kind of go to the next level, we were transitioning from waterfall to agile. So where before we would kind of get 3 months or, you know, 3 months to kind of put something together and then sort of chuck it over the wall to IT, we were going into agile. So we'd kind of had the IT version of what agile was, and then nobody really mentioned how UX worked. And we flagged that up, and, you know, we escalated and said, look, it's not clear how UX works within agile. Like, there isn't really any, we can't just start the story, you know, and with no pre-work or no thought, you know, otherwise we'll end up making a Frankenstein checkout.
Yeah.
We need to do some thought. So I kind of got this permission, because there was a vacuum of leadership when it came to how UX should work in agile, where I created this thing called sort of shaping, is what we called it. And that was really where we sort of said that before an agile piece of work started, we would be able to have 3-4 weeks to like a discovery phase before it started. And I started to shape exactly what that looked like and bring in user tests to that, which, you know, we'd been doing user tests, but trying to sort of formalize it and make the discovery period a bit more pronounced. And this was all going up on the walls, and we were starting to create prototypes, which hadn't been done before, like, you know, in Xeer and stuff, which was like a really big leap for us to be able to finish a discovery phase that wasn't really being done in that way before, and have clickable prototypes, have the team have a more standardized approach to doing shapings before. Or it was a bit kind of ad hoc, whereas we're starting to kind of establish, okay, well, let's do some user testing, let's do some prototyping, let's do some competitor reviews, let's do some sketching. So we started formalizing that process, and that meant that our discovery phase got noticed a bit more on the kind of governance level, because it was like, well, have you finished the shaping yet? So that was almost like a kind of state that had to happen before a project could start. So that was kind of like ebbing into the next level.
That's perfect. And I think what you've done there is you've introduced another technique into the mix alongside all the ones we've talked about so far, which is that formalizing of, you know, ad hoc processes and turning them into a formalized process so that there is an expectation that is what we do, and that that is clearly communicated. So do you think that that kind of formalization and policies and procedures and all that kind of stuff, was that a big part of your approach?
I think it needed it at the start because we're still an immature team. And I think that there was a lot of change going around, and I think we needed to give some kind of structure and clarity. You know, once we imposed a little bit of clarity around what we were doing before a piece of work started, I was actually fine to let the team turn it into what they needed to. But we needed to give confidence to the senior team that we needed time before a project.
Yeah.
And, you know, they needed to listen to the results, because that would basically... What I determined, and I'm trying to make this succinct, was that this was one of the key moments for me. Is I was trying to work out who decides how long a project is, because these were still project based. This wasn't productized streams. So who decides that it's 3 months?
Mm-hmm.
Where does that come from? And what I realized was that essentially a business analyst would work with a project manager, and the business analyst was telling IT, our guys will need about 10 sprints to do this. And so UX, we just had to fit into the estimate of the development sprints. There was no, well, maybe that takes IT, you know, one sprint to do, but it might take UX, like, you know, 3 weeks to work out.
Mm-hmm.
So what I managed to do was to get that shaping phase into the estimation. So that when they funded a project, they would have to look at our prototypes and our kind of intended experience. So then the funding was going to be based on our ideal sort of, you know, shape of experience, rather than IT's version, which would be really hardcore MVP.
Yeah.
And that was quite significant as well.
So going to the other extreme in all of this, what was the biggest kind of cultural hurdle that you had to overcome?
I think at that stage, where we started to hit the buffers a bit was actually the environment and the tooling at that stage. Really? There were much bigger things that I ended up doing, but it was, we were only just transitioned to laptops. The laptops were dying. You know, the environment was not, it wasn't hot desking or anything like that. Everybody had fixed desks. It was quite hard to kind of create a kind of workshopping, free-flowing sort of, it didn't feel like a creative space at all. And the team were kind of frustrated a bit, because they would get put on these huge, long projects that would sort of have not much creative element to them, and, you know, it'd be very kind of IT driven. So one of the really big things that I did that actually did seem to really move things as far as the leadership team were concerned is that I had a remit to run a team event. So this is just within UX.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of organized a mini one-day hackathon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just within my team, so it was about 8 of us, and we had 2 teams, and we had a design challenge, and we did a very quick UCD process, made a prototype by the end of the day, rushed out onto the high street, gorilla tested it, came back and presented it to a couple of the senior team that came in at the end. And it was a very kind of small hackathon. It was just UXers, we were just using Azure. There wasn't, you know, a broader scope at that point, but that showed them that our team could actually produce things, you know, a much kind of more rapid scale, and, you know, there was kind of a different type of capability involved. The next year, I then kind of, it's a little bit complicated how it came about, but I managed to persuade quite a lot of senior people for us to do a larger hackathon. So then what I was able to do was to kind of, through a lot of coercion, and I had support from the IT director, was to, which was part of a kind of, you know, IT want to be shown to supporting the online department as being innovative and all this kind of thing. So they helped give me a bit of funding for it. And I organized, you know, the food, the space, mm-hmm. exactly how it would work. And I ran a hackathon with about 50, 60 people. This was cross-departmental. So we had UX designers, graphic designers. We had business owners coming in. We had about three or four teams. I got the internal comms team to film it and have a kind of documentary style kind of recording that they were live streaming. You know, we had prizes, we had a stage, you know, and the director came in at the end and judged it all and all this kind of thing. And what was really interesting about that is that it kind of, again, created a lot of noise for our department. You know, mm-hmm. we've kind of known around the businesses, oh, they're doing a hackathon. Most people didn't know what a hackathon was. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it was sort of like a term that most people weren't familiar with. So I had to do a lot of work with internal comms, which meant I got a lot of PR for our team of what's a hackathon, what's UX, all this kind of thing. But where it really was quite interesting was that as a result of all the noise, I got a seat at a very small table for about 10 minutes in front of Andy Street, who is the director of, at the time he was running John Lewis.
Okay.
And he's now the mayor of Birmingham, I think. And I managed to get, because of this kind of fanfare and the excitement and buzz that we had kind of produced, you know, three apps in a day using prototyping and tested it and all this kind of stuff. So he was kind of interested to hear about it. So I used that platform to first just say, you know, how great it was. And I said, look, we want to do that. We did the prototypes. We want to do it for real. We want to be mm-hmm. able to make apps and test things really quickly. And I said to him, but we can't. We can't do it because we don't have the right laptops. The floor looks the same as it does in accounts. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to modernize and this needs to feel like a fresh and creative space. And he said, no, I'm going to give you budget for that.
Wow.
And I said to him, look, this is ripping up the carpets. This isn't just a lick of paint. And then when he did a talk back to the department, he used that phrase. He said, look, we're not going to do a lick of paint. You know, we're going to rip up the carpets.
Right.
And so that, the mandate was already there, but I think what I was able to do was to really set the tone for him.
Yeah.
Set the expectation that if he likes the sound of the noise coming out of the hackathon, that's really what this kind of proposed floor redesign that was coming up needed to be. So I was able to piggyback
mm-hmm.
on the back of it and make it much bigger than it was intended to be.
Mm.
So that's
it's
a long story, but you can kind of see that how it kind of got more pace. And we even got sponsored by Exua. You know, I just wrote to them and they gave us like £1,000 to pay for the food.
Brilliant.
You know, so there was lots of different angles to it. I can go on, but I'll
Give us how far were you able to push this? We're running out of time a little bit, but sure. But I'm interested, before you decided to move on in your career, how far did you manage to push things at John Lewis before you left?
So where things got really crazy was that following that hackathon, we had a new floor, and then it was like, okay, right, so we've got new floor, hot desking, all this kind of stuff. What I then turned my attention to, so if you think about the different levels, initially I'd done the ground floor. So I'd done, you know, the boards, ways of working, mm-hmm. in getting agile done. Then I'd gone up a level, looked at like hackathon and kind of the environment and helping change the workspace, all this kind of thing. And then the next level was kind of looking at governance and strategy. We had a really good there were two online directors that had started, and they were really, really supportive and really, really inspiring for me. And one of them gave me the Value Proposition Design book. She actually handed out 20 copies.
Brilliant.
I don't think many people read it back to back, but I kind of hoovered it up. And what I tried to do was to think about how to make value proposition design, which is really a methodology for startups, the way it's positioned. Mm. And I was like, how do I make that work inside this organization? How do I make that work inside a sprint? How do I make that work inside when we're working out how to do a project. So what I did is that I put together a presentation, and I spent probably about 3 months on it, making it. Wow. You know, the best presentation, you know, the slides, the graphics, you know, it made a huge difference. And I spent absolutely ages refining this presentation. And I was sort of kind of, you know, transmorphing value proposition design into a sort of, you know, here's practically how it works in this environment that we're all in now.
Mm.
And what I did was I started to present this presentation, firstly to my team, then to some other teams. And then what I did is it was a Google slide document, and I locked it so that people wanted to see the slideshow afterwards. And I locked it so they couldn't share it. They could only view it.
Right.
And then what started to happen is that in this value proposition design, I was talking about, you know, how to do proper test and learn a governance level. So I would say I was making suggestions that on a sprint level, we don't start a story until we have some degree of confidence. On a governance level, we don't kick off a project until we've got some degree of confidence. Mm. And then we can maybe talk about releasing a little bit of funds and doing a bit more on a project. And these were like quite big ideas. And then I was saying at a strategic level, we need to think about how we can validate. So I was doing this kind of big presentation, and there's actually a copy of it on YouTube. If you type in Dibby Danny Hearn, you can find it. And I started to get invited by different business teams who'd heard about this presentation, and they wanted access to the document. Like, I'll just send it over and we'll have a look. And I said, no, the only way you get to see it is if I present it. I won't let you just see it. Because I knew if they just opened it, they just flicked through it and then like shrugged their shoulders. So I was like, I have to present it. So that got me access to all their team meetings. And so then I started doing team meetings probably, you know, 2-3 a week, different floors, different departments, business development teams, IT teams, analyst teams, all over the business. And I was sort of basically coaching them in how to rethink how they commission work and how they fund it and how they validate it.
Mm-hmm.
That then went up to, I got sort of to chat to the finance director, John Lewis, the HR director, and I was talking about creating KPIs for teams that would be based on customer goals that was set from the strategy. And we'd have customer goals and business goals at a strategic level, and then each department and each director, each like part of the business would have to work out how they could meet that customer goal and how they could validate it.
Mm.
So it was something that I was then invited into the strategic team at John Lewis to help form the customer strategy, which was way outside of online. And I was bringing in customer goals and business goals, and then how will you measure it? And so I was bringing in ideas about measuring customer goals into the John Lewis strategy. And then what I was trying to do is to coerce the mid levels at a project level. They would have to say, which customer goals does this project fulfill?
Yeah.
And then at a HR level, for your annual KPIs, which customer goals, like you've got your own objectives, how does your objective meet that customer goal? And so I'd created a hook that could run through the organization from right from the top, where they have very, very high level customer goals, right down to a sprint or right down to an individual's KPI. And they could work out their relative measure, because everyone's measure of how they're going to meet that customer goal is going to be unique depending on what level of influence they have.
Mm.
So it got really big. I don't think I completely achieved it. I don't think it was fully embedded when I left. But I think there was a lot of attention, and certainly some of the principles are still in place today.
And what I like about that, what really resonates with me, is that your role became outward looking from outside of your team to really drawing in the rest of the organization, that you were invested not in just managing your little silo, but in, you know, getting out there, presenting, you know, engaging with the rest of the organization, which is absolutely key. If you want to really embed user experience, we need to be user experience advocates as much as we need to be user experience implementers. And I think that's such an important lesson that I think a lot of people miss. Danny, thank you so much for sharing all of that. Where can people find out more about what you're up to now and follow you, etc.? Anywhere good?
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. So if you check out my website, it's www.danny.hearn.me.
Okay.
That's got my blog on it and anything else you want to find out.
Brilliant. All right. Thank you so much for your time, Danny, and good luck with the future.
Cool. Thanks, Paul. Yeah. Great to be on Vogue World at last. That's one on the bucket list.
I don't believe a word of it.
Cheers, Paul.
I think the thing that I loved about that one was how you things can start small and grow.
My first, well, is this the same point? But my third point I had written down when I was listening, taking notes, is small things matter. Basically, he got things done by doing lots of small things. I mean, it got more important, but yeah, just kind of the boards on the wall and all that kind of thing, you know. Those little things, rather than thinking I'm going to digitally transform this, you know, this organization, it's just like little bits here and there can make, you know, it creates that kind of you know, the ball getting to the top of the hill and rolling down the other side effect, which has a name, but I can't think what it is.
Momentum,
that'll do.
I mean, that's what struck me, was that he built momentum as he went along. So to begin with, it's very small little things. Mm. But as he became more confident, and as the organisation became more confident in him, so he could start doing bigger and bigger and bigger things over time. It was a really good example about how, you know, even if you're just a small cog in an enormous organisation that, like John Lewis, which is big, you know, you can still make a difference, but it's about perseverance. It would have been, I mean, take the boards for example, it would have been so easy for him just to have kind of backed down from that and gone, oh, well, fire fair enough.
Yeah. But also, I mean, the setting up of that hackathon when he said that when he was getting £1,000 for food, that was a great example of how hard it is to do these things. You think, oh yes, so we can set up a kind of thing where everybody comes along and we do exercises, but it's more than that. It kind of shows you that you have to be really very bothered. I watched a talk last week by a guy who was talking more about content related stuff, but it was the same kind of thing. It was about, you know, making change happen, and he said that you need to recognize that, this is kind of more senior people, but you need to recognize who your influencers are. And hit this, Danny Hearn is an influencer. He went in and influenced people's behavior by doing stuff. And that's what I really got from it. It was great. Yeah, just do little bits here, little bits there, little bits here, little bits there. And you know, we've always sort of said, oh, you need to educate and this kind of thing. And it's like, well, actually, you just need to kind of plug stuff into people's lives and they'll get used to it, which I thought was great.
Yeah, really good interview. In fact, I would go as far as saying that has been my favourite of the season. I think last week was your favourite, wasn't it?
It was, because it was more businessy, more like kind of agency stuff, but
yeah. But for me, this one, that was a really good one. I really enjoyed that, and thank you, Danny, so much for coming on the show and sharing that experience with us. I'll put a link in the show notes to all of Danny's stuff, dannyhearn.me and all of that kind of stuff. Definitely check him out and hire him, because he's a smart guy.
He is.
Or hire me first, then hire him. You know, just get that clear. All right, let's talk about our second sponsor, which is Full Story. Full Story is, as I have said every time in this season, so much so that you're probably sick of hearing it, is the best session recorder out there, bar none. We all know that session recorders basically allow you to watch back user sessions, which is incredibly useful for getting insights into people's natural behavior on your site. But some session recorders can be quite frustrating, not naming any names. So you get overwhelmed by the huge number of sessions, and it's hard to find what it is that you want. And you have to plan ahead to gather the data on a particular behavior you're looking after. But Full Story solves these issues. It records everything about all sessions on your site, meaning you don't have to plan ahead. You can search on almost anything at any time, from what text people have clicked on to what DOM elements they've interacted with, And even track moments of frustration, like rage clicks and things like that. And you can search and filter by all of this stuff. So it really is incredibly powerful. You can sign up today and get a free month of their pro account for free. No need to enter a credit card detail. And if you want to continue using that for free after that month, you can get up to 1,000 sessions per month recorded. Obviously, if you want more than that, you can shell out some cash, and it's worth every penny for it. So to go and have a play with it, try it out, see whether you like it, go to fullstory.com/boag. All right, Marcus, you got a joke to finish us up with?
I have. This one's from Dave Smith on the Joke Channel. The only thing flat earthists fear is sphere itself.
Oh, my word.
That was really hard to say.
All right. That was. I want to try a little experiment, right? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
At this point, I want to see whether Google Home outjokes you. All right?
Probably so will.
Let me get my Google Home. Hey, Google, tell me a joke.
Okay, here you go. How many introverts does it take to screw in a light bulb? Why does it have to be a group activity?
No, that's worse. Much worse than mine.
Oh, I thought it was quite good. But it was worse than yours, I have to say. I liked yours more. So there you go. You need to buy yourself a Google Home so that you can find shitty jokes.
Yeah, well, I could ask Alexa. I've got the Amazon version.
Oh, there you go. Ask Alexa. Mm. See what she comes up with. All right, so that wraps us up for this episode. I hope everybody enjoyed it. And we'll be back again next week for another episode of I Can't Remember What It Is. Like that kind of
the penultimate show of the series.
Yeah, that kind of petered out at the end, didn't it? Oh, I remember. Yeah, it's James. James from Unicef. Okay. Joining us next week. So that'll be a good one. I'm looking forward to that. But until then, thanks for listening. Bye.